This is your typical radio ad while eating a Crunch Bar.
This is Automatic of Otto's Used Cars. This weekend only, we're having a whale! Bring the kids. See for yourself. It is huge. Gonna make a big splash. No other dealer can say they have a whale like this.
When things sound dull, turn up the fun with Crunch.
Four papers every morning and three screens of television. All the trouble to the world and all the things he was doing wrong. The declining polls, the rising frustrations.
Lady Bird has anticipated this moment for years. When all their best intentions, all that progress on civil rights and the rest of the great society would be overshadowed by Vietnam and by the limits of Lyndon's ability to bring the country together. But when that day comes, she's still somehow blindsided by it. The trouble is, as much as she could see this day coming, seeing past it is a whole lot harder. From Best Case Studios and ABC Audio, this is In Plain Sight. I'm Julia Swag. Episode 6, Blindsided.
'Cause you have seen some unbelievable things.
It's October 1967, and Lady Bird is headed to New England in all its autumn glory. Two colleges have started new and substantial environmental studies programs, and Lady Bird is happy to lend her high-profile support to help legitimize them.
Sunday, October the 8th, Liz and I left the White House a little past 10 and flew to an airport in North Adams, Massachusetts, one of the pleasantest rides I can remember. The mayor greeted us, I was given a key, and we went quickly on into Williamstown, a picture postcard New England city.
At Williams College, her first stop is an event at the home of the president.
We're hosting a luncheon for 60 people, the degree recipients, the trustees, all the faculty. It took me around to meet everyone, and then very soon we sat down. I was next to a very interesting man, Hugh Bullock. I gathered he was the chief trustee. He was quite outspoken in his approval of Lyndon. And that was one of the last words of approval I was to hear that day.
Mrs. Lyndon B. Johnson comes to Williams College. President John Sawyer escorts the First Lady to the ceremony at Chapin Hall. She took no formal notice of a group of anti-war pickets who staged a silent vigil protesting the Vietnam War.
The small campus is crowded with protesters. In the days before Lady Bird arrives at Williams College, half the professors and more than half of the undergrads sign a petition against the war, saying it diverts funds that are needed for urgent environmental problems at home. They arrive at Chapin Hall for the ceremony. The students have arranged a silent dissent against the war. Many are wearing white armbands over their robes.
We took our seats on the stage. I looked out into the audience in front of me. The first several dozen rows were the graduating class in their black robes, and as I saw a white armband on the first one, I was not quite prepared for it, and I felt a quick pulse of emotion in my throat. I counted another and another.
And the protest doesn't stop there.
And it was at this point that some of the graduating class walked out.
Lady Bird gives her speech. She's determined to stay on message.
Then we filed out. The pickets were still there, but louder now. And a funny thing, as you turned your back and started on up the hill, and they were behind you, the ugly murmur rose in volume, and I heard calls of shame, shame.
Even more students have arrived from nearby colleges, joining the vigil.
How did I personally feel as I walked among the picketers? Cool and firm and tough. But through every pore, you sense a sort of an animal passion right below the surface. There's something weird and animal about mob psychology, and I wondered what would have happened if I had suddenly broken to a run. The second day of my journey into academia began crisp and bright. There were pictures on the front step with the staff of the house, beaming, nice, colored people.
There are times when I hear the incredible distance between the world Ladybird comes from, one where she poses for photographs with beaming, nice, colored people, and the one she's confronting more and more as the 1960s progress.
And then began the ride through the back roads of New England, and it was an enchanting journey. Maples turning crimson and gold against the backdrop of green pines, and asters and goldenrod all along the roadside. And about 3 o'clock, we arrived at New Haven at the residence of the Brewsters.
Kingman Brewster is the president of Yale. Under his leadership, the college has started to make an effort at diversity, accepting a few Jewish kids, black kids. Still, no women. That'll take another 2 years. George W. Bush is a senior at the time. Cartoonist Gary Trudeau is majoring in graphic design. And the author of Hamilton, Ron Chernow, who took a grand total of one history class in his time at Yale, is a sophomore.
I had been to the Brewsters once before.
Lady Bird had been to Yale in 1965 as part of her research into architects for the LBJ Library.
This time, it was a very different arrival. A sizable crowd of picketers in front of the house, carrying signs that said, "Stop beautifying North Vietnam. Tell LBJ, withdraw now," and displayed pictures of people supposedly burned by napalm.
President Brewster is different this time, too.
Quite soon, the feeling got across to me that my presence here was really an imposition on him. If I have any antenna at all, I sense that he wished he had no part of it.
It's not hard to imagine why. The Yale Daily News has just published an open letter to the First Lady against the war in Vietnam, hand-delivered to one of her Secret Service agents. It's signed by 600 students and faculty. The letter reads, "We are alarmed and dismayed by the dimensions of the American military commitment in that country and at the diverting of resources from vital domestic needs. We are, above all, saddened by the loss of life, both Vietnamese and American." Instead of walking the short distance from President Brewster's house to War Memorial Hall for her speech, past all those picketers, she decides to drive. Outside the hall, a silent vigil awaits her. At this point, she's fully on the defensive, determined that the protesters are the problem.
To me, it seemed a curiously fascist sort of an atmosphere, very conformist, and I wondered how anyone would dare speak out on the other side.
Mayor Richard Lee has been an ally, but unrest in New Haven over displacement from urban renewal and the town's squalid ghetto conditions have made him politically vulnerable. Today, he sent his wife in his place, claiming laryngitis. Brewster, introducing the First Lady to the 800 students and faculty, talks about his own anti-war activism against Woodrow Wilson.
The impression to me was that he was disassociating himself from President Johnson, letting his own constituency, that is, the students and faculty, know that he was with them in heart.
She tries starting with a joke. It's a thing you do when you feel like the audience isn't on your side.
I belong to the generation which thinks that when you take a trip, you go on a barge down the Mississippi River.
Her joke doesn't really land. Yale is launching a major environmental studies program, and this is an audience to whom Lady Bird can explain very directly what she really means by that word beautification. Certainly, it is not the exclusive concern of old ladies in tennis shoes, she says. How can we rebuild the core of our cities? How can we bring order rather than chaos out of our highways and transit systems? How can we provide parks and open space to let our cities breathe and our people relax? How can we control the waste we pour into our air and water? Beautification means our total concern for the physical and human quality of the world we pass on to our children. It's the best distillation of her environmentalism, the full scope of it, that she's ever delivered.
I got a standing ovation, long and loud and clear, and I hope they heard it outside.
Lady Bird's reaction to her trip is that it was a bust, and she's come away from it more embattled, more at odds with the protest movement that's sweeping the country.
Both campuses seemed quite set apart from the world, insulated, encased in gelatin, with a window on only one issue, Vietnam. That
ceiling of a fascist society where everybody thinks the same thing and does the same thing, and anybody who dares not has to be pretty brave. A sort of McCarthyism in reverse.
But this whole experience has also demonstrated something to her in unmistakable terms, really for the first time. She's starting to feel out of touch.
That was also a lesson to me. I must not live in the White House, insulated myself. I want to know what's going on, even if the no is to suffer. No
more! 10 days later, on October 21st, almost 100,000 protesters converge on Washington.
The day of the big gathering of dissenters on Vietnam. There's a ripple of excitement in the air. There's almost a feeling of being under siege.
There's a rally at the Lincoln Memorial, organized by Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, founders of the radical performance art slash activist group, the Yippies. Some fly Viet Cong flags or carry signs saying things like, "Dump Johnson," and even perversely, "Where is Oswald when we need him?" Their antics were recorded by filmmakers Edward Folger and Larry Sturhan.
We will march directly to the Pentagon. If you are here for peace, let me hear your voice. You want me?
It showed the depth of the wave that was sweeping the country. An avalanche, a tidal wave.
At the Pentagon, beat poet Allen Ginsberg stages a levitation. The underground band, the Fugs, perform an exorcism.
Out, demons out. Out, demons out. Out, demons out.
And a, quote, "groping for peace."
For the first time in the history of the Pentagon, there will be a groping within 100 feet of this place.
Time magazine sums up the crowd as a melting pot of dissent, circa 1967. Hard-eyed revolutionaries and skylarking hippies, ersatz motorcycle gangs and all-too-real college professors, housewives, ministers, and authors, black nationalists in African garb, nonviolent pacifists and American Nazis spoiling for a fight. Lady Bird makes other plans.
I plan to stay at home all day. Maybe for once I'll get a clear desk.
The Johnsons are just months away from the date Lady Bird had circled on the calendar 4 years earlier in May of 1964, when LBJ would announce he's not running for re-election. If anything, she's more sure about that plan than ever.
I did not want to go through the grueling 6 months of another campaign, but even more, I did not want to face another 4 years as devouring as these last four have been.
They're both having nightmares.
Lyndon reaches out to me more than ever, and yet I do not have the wisdom, the foresight for the answer. The only gift I have is the assurance that I will be content and happy saying goodbye to all this.
Lyndon's an emotional roller coaster. Energized one day and anxious wreck the next. And letting go is hard, even for her.
I want to see him spend himself, almost whatever it takes, against this virus that is infecting our country.
Always, Lyndon's health is on her mind. How much time do they have left together?
And yet it would be so easy, so happy, to draw a circle around our family and have fun for what is left to us of life. He said, "There's one job I want, and that's to be a full-time grandfather." It was both humorous and pathetic.
In the candid photos I've seen at the LBJ Library, Lyndon does look like a natural with babies. He goes out of his way to swing through Austin to see his first grandchild, Lucy's baby Lynn, or have him at the ranch or in the Oval Office. There are images of baby Lynn with his grandparents gumming presidential documents labeled top secret. Over the New Year's holiday, Lady Bird and Lyndon go into Austin to see Hello Dolly with Texas Governor John Connally and his wife Nellie. The two couples have known one another for almost 40 years.
And Lyndon and John and Nellie and I have settled down in the living room to talk about families, painting, and farming. Politics obtruded hardly at all into our conversation.
They leave for the LBJ Ranch, where the Connollys and the Johnsons have a tradition of spending a few days together over the New Year's break.
We left after 12:30 and drove through the pea soup fog to the ranch. Weather fit only to sit around the fire and tell tales, as Daddy would have said.
Eventually, though, they do turn to the elephant in the room. The Connollys are some of the only people who know that LBJ's seriously considering not running for re-election.
We went back to Lyndon's bedroom, the four of us, and talked without interruption for nearly 3 hours. John said, "You ought to run only if you really look forward to being president again, only if you want to do it."
For the moment, John Connolly has decided not to stand for another term as governor. He and Nellie can speak from experience.
Some of the most lucid and interesting words were spoken by Nellie. She said, "You're probably fine after you've made the decision if you decide not to run. There's a sort of a funereal period. You almost feel like you're dead. And then when that has passed, there's a great wave of relief."
But like she has before, Lady Bird is thinking about legacy.
"And yet, if he chooses to get out, what will history say of him? What will the soldiers in Vietnam say of him? Who knows, who knows?" And so we went round and round on the same hot griddle, finding no cool oasis, no acceptable exit.
In less than 2 weeks, there'll be what seems like the ideal moment for an announcement, the President's State of the Union Address.
Wednesday, January the 17th, the day of the State of the Union.
Lyndon has been working with his staff on the State of the Union. Lots of people work on the speech that lays out his policy plans for 1968. But Lyndon asks only his press secretary, George Christian, and naturally, Lady Bird, to help write his exit statement. Lady Bird has kept the draft she'd written almost 4 years earlier in Huntland, the first time Lyndon talked about getting out.
"I brought it out, and we reread what I had said then, and George read it. It sounds better now."
In the end, though, they decide to use George Christian's statement. LBJ folds it up and tucks it into the inside pocket of his suit jacket. No one knows what LBJ is planning, so they won't have anything on the teleprompter. The plan is for LBJ to finish his State of the Union address, then reach into his pocket, grab this exit statement, and read it.
He looks from one to another of those close to him for an answer, for some wisdom, some foresight beyond any he can have. There isn't any. There is nobody but him.
Hi, I'm Chris Gethard, and I'm very excited to tell you about Beautiful Anonymous, a podcast where I talk to random people on the phone. I tweet out a phone number, thousands of people try to call, you talk to one of them, they stay anonymous, I can't hang up, that's all the rules. I never know what's going to happen. We get serious ones. I've talked with meth dealers on their way to prison. I've talked to people who survived mass shootings. Crazy funny ones. I talked to a guy with a goose laugh, somebody who dresses up as a pirate on the weekends. I never know what's going to happen. It's a great show. Subscribe today, Beautiful Anonymous.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
The speech is at 9 that night. Around 5:30, Lady Bird's upstairs in the private quarters and sees that Lyndon has changed into a different suit. She discovers the statement still in his pocket. She grabs it and goes off to find him. She finds Lyndon in the fish room across from the Oval Office. FDR used to keep an aquarium in there. JFK kept the name and hung up a 10-foot sailfish trophy he caught in Acapulco on his honeymoon. Lady Bird redecorated. The president is meeting with a bunch of Democratic congressmen and members of his cabinet. It's a room full of men.
I seldom interrupt meetings like that, but I had this memo in my keeping, and I held it like a coal of fire, and I wanted to get it back in his pocket. So I took it over. He was rushed, standing in the door. What do you think? What shall I do?
Lyndon and his indecision. It's exhausting.
I've said it all before. I can't tell you what to do. Either you make a conscious decision to run, or simply make the announcement at a time and in words that only you can choose.
They're rushed, and there are people all around. They can't really have this conversation again.
He handed me a piece of paper. It was from John Conley. His recommendations that he go with the statement tonight because he would never have a bigger audience. I think what John really meant was that this was a noble time to do it.
That night, Lady Bird watches from the house gallery with her daughters and their husbands, along with Walter Washington and his wife, Benetta.
And Lyndon came in to a thundering applause.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the Congress, and my fellow Americans, I was thinking as I was walking down the aisle there tonight.
He looked wonderful. 15 or more pounds he's lost shows, and all to the good. And I like his hair growing longer just a little bit.
As much as the Johnsons might like to keep the focus on the Great Society, on progressive legislation and civil rights, by 1968, with so much upheaval in America, the winds have shifted, and so have their priorities.
Know that the American people have had enough of rising crime and lawlessness in this country.
Lady Bird told herself after her trip to Williams and Yale that she didn't want to live in a bubble. But now she's in one. Tonight, she's thinking more about landing a political win, that applause line about crime and lawlessness, than about their original liberal agenda.
As we approached the end, I tightened up in my seat. Would he reach in his pocket?
So this, my friends, is the state of our union. Seeking, building, tested many times this past year, and always equal to the test.
He did not reach in his pocket for the draft that I knew was there.
Thank you and good night.
He turned and walked down the steps.
Despite the applause in the room, the reviews the next day are tepid at best. Still, Lady Bird has to carry on. The next day is the first doers' luncheon, her gatherings of professional women at the White House, in over a year. Lyndon's crime bill was the centerpiece of his State of the Union address. So with this doers' luncheon, Lady Bird is doing her part.
I went over my guest list for the Women Doers Luncheon. Our subject, crime on the streets. I felt I haven't raised my voice to do what little bit I could.
Butlers passed sherry and orange juice. The 50-odd guests, journalists, teachers, authors, and community activists, some black, mostly white, take their seats in the family dining room. There are three speakers on the program. The biggest star in the room is one of the last to arrive. She's the 41-year-old singer, dancer, and actor who's been lighting up America's living rooms on ABC's hit show, Batman. Her name's Eartha Kitt. She brings a new, bracing sex appeal to the role of Catwoman and an unmistakable voice.
You'd better pray that Batman is a man-man more than he is a policeman. Angora, get her ready for the grand opening. Yes, my dear. You will make a perfect pinafore.
Kitt's also a big activist. After the 1965 Watts riots in L.A., she financed dance schools for local teens. She's working with the youth group Rebels With a Cause in the heavily segregated D.C. neighborhood of Anacostia.
Miss Kitt, you've been associated with these youth. Do you see a long, hot summer for Washington with potential? Is Washington a riot city?
Well, I think it's capable of being a riot city. I do not think that as long as you have organizations such as the Rebels With a Cause who understand their own problems because they're living with it day by day, that these kind of organizations...
Eartha Kitt was born in the Low Country of South Carolina, where her mother worked as the black domestic staff of a white doctor, Eartha's father. Her mother was too young to raise a child on her own, so she sent her 3-year-old daughter to live with a distant relative. As a small child, Kit picked cotton in the Jim Crow South. At age 8, she was sent alone on a train in the colored-only car to New York City. She wound up living with a Cuban family in Spanish Harlem. Eartha took the subway 100 blocks to a performing arts high school, but she dropped out when she landed a spot with Katherine Dunham, the country's first African-American modern dance company. She got gigs in Mexico City, London, Paris, Berlin, places where Black artists and performers were appreciated with less of America's baggage around race. She was becoming a confident, charismatic, code-switching, multilingual talent. In 1953, she released That Bad Eartha, which features the song I Wanna Be Evil. It's becoming a persona for her, the bad girl with a good heart.
I wanna go to the devil, wanna be evil. I wanna spit tacks. I wanna be evil and cheat at jacks. I wanna be.
The dawn of the civil rights movement intersects with the McCarthy era, when the Red Scare put a lot of American artists on blacklists, often because they were deemed too outspoken. Kit was friends with writers James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison, director Orson Welles, all of them under scrutiny for their public critiques of American racism. The FBI set up surveillance on many Black activists and artists. Kit is one of them. She gets her own file. Kit comes to the Doers Luncheon straight from the Pentagon, where she was meeting about a tour to entertain troops in Vietnam. File or no file, she's a patriot. But what's supposed to be a typical White House luncheon is about to get turned upside down.
I'm very happy to welcome you here to the family dining room of the White House on this beautiful day. Crime is a grim subject for a pleasant meeting like this. But I believe that everybody is increasingly determined to face up to it.
The White House footage of the event shows lots of ladies, many wearing hats, many smoking, mustard-colored drapes, yellow walls, gold-painted bamboo chairs. There are two head tables by the podium, Lady Bird's at one with the speakers, and Eartha is at the other with NBC's Nancy Dickerson and Washington Post publisher Kay Graham. The first speaker is Margaret Moore, an old-school anti-crime crusader. As she begins her remarks, a voice from the back of the room interrupts.
Ms. Moore?
Yes.
They ask Ms. Moore to yield to a, quote, more prominent speaker. It's the president. Maybe his drop by is a kind of apology to Lady Bird for what didn't happen the night before when he didn't announce he's stepping aside. In the footage, he's relaxed, enjoying himself, chatting with his wife's guests about his crime bill. Lyndon says that he's impressed by women and their tenacity. Reminds him of a bulldog. It's a compliment. LBJ gets ready to leave, but Eartha stands up and stops him at the podium.
What do we do about delinquent parents?
Eartha says that they're all focused on delinquent youth. But, she asks the president, what about delinquent parents?
The parents who have to go to work, for instance, who can't spend the time with their children that they should.
This, she says, is our main problem. It's a bold move to approach the president like this, unplanned and unscripted. You could say it's out of line. It's certainly not White House protocol. LBJ handles it fine. Eartha Kitt's probably a good foot shorter than the president. He towers over her. LBJ leans on the podium and looks straight into her eyes as he answers. The Johnson treatment. He answers by talking about the Social Security bill that's just been passed and the millions of dollars allocated for daycare centers. He says it's the work of a bunch of men who probably aren't the best judges of how to handle children. So maybe that's a good question for this room of women. And he wraps it up. And then he's gone. Eartha sits down and lights a cigarette. The camera pans between her and the next speaker.
She sat down, stubbed out a cigarette, and from then on I watched her, expecting something I didn't know what. Apparently, she did not eat, nor did she clap for any of the speakers.
One of the speakers is making her remarks. Eartha Kitt is gathering her thoughts. Something's not sitting right.
She smoldered and smoked. I noticed Miss Kitt's hand going up. I did not know what to expect, only that it would not be good. When some speaker finished, I nodded to her. She rose and began to talk swiftly, passionately.
Kitt does ramble, darting from topic to topic. But she ultimately gets to her point, and it's not what anyone expects.
Mounting to a crescendo, she came to her real destination, to denounce the war in Vietnam.
This isn't their subject today. This Doers' Luncheon is about crime in America's streets. At the White House, you don't go off topic.
And then, advancing a step toward me and looking with intense directness at me, "She's a good actress," she said. "You send the best of this country off to be shot and maimed. They rebel in the street. They will take pot, and they will get high. They don't want to go to school, because they're going to be snatched off from their mothers to be shot in Vietnam." I am glad to say I looked back just as directly, stare for stare. I continued, pointing a finger, the paper said.
I've looked at the footage. Nobody's doing any pointing. There are actually a couple of days between this Doers' Lunch and when Lady Bird recorded her diary entry. And that matters, because the White House spin machine had taken over by that point, and it colors Lady Bird's story.
How do you feel in a situation like this? First, a wave of mounting disbelief. Can this be true? Is it a nightmare? Then a sort of surge of adrenaline into the blood, knowing that you're going to answer, you've got to answer, you want to answer.
For her diary entry for this day, she's relying on two sources. She's reading from the transcript of the lunch. There's only audio for part of it. And she's looking at press clippings that came out in its aftermath.
Somewhere along the way, I had a sense that maybe the feeling in the room was swinging to me.
Betty Hughes, the wife of the governor of New Jersey, jumps in. She and Lady Bird are friends. Her rebuttal? "I consider that anybody who's taking pot just because there is a war in Vietnam is some kind of kook." Now, there's the establishment talking. While Betty Hughes is doing her thing, Lady Bird is trying to gather her thoughts. Finally, she stands. "Miss Kitt," she says, "I believe that I should like to answer you." Lady Bird's initial response is thoughtful and empathetic.
"I cannot identify as much as I should. I have not lived the background you have."
But she's still a disciplined political animal, and she quickly reverts to her talking points.
"Because there is a war on, and I pray that there will be a just and honest peace, that still doesn't give us a free ticket not to try to work for better things. We must keep our eyes and our hearts and our energies fixed on constructive areas and try to do something that will make this a happier, better educated land."
That just sounds like the defensive, in-the-bubble kind of thinking she says she wants to avoid.
"Nor can I speak as passionately and well."
And that word passionately sounds to me like code. In Washington, but hardly just there, you're not supposed to get too emotional, especially if you're a woman. Even more so if you're a Black woman. The Doers' Luncheon ends, but the White House PR apparatus is just getting going. And the media is happy to join in.
Eartha Kitt, whose outburst yesterday at a White House luncheon against the war, taxes, and the alienation of youth drew attention rivaling the standard responses to the State of the Union.
NBC's Nancy Dickerson tells Lady Bird's press secretary, Liz Carpenter, that she thinks maybe Kitt was on Helen Gurley Brown's Cosmo wine diet, meaning hungry, tipsy, lightheaded. Liz puts out a statement in Lady Bird's name saying, "The shrill voice of anger and discord had drowned out the otherwise constructive discussion." A few of the journalists at the lunch that day report that Kitt made Lady Bird cry, which is humiliating and not true. Back at her hotel over a scotch, Eartha thinks about sending the First Lady a bouquet of flowers and an apology, but her manager tells her not to. It's probably already too late to go high. By the time she lands back in L.A. the next day, Kitt tells the press that the First Lady was a little flustered and emotional. Two strong women reduced to caricature. Kitt holds a press conference to tell her story, it's become an incident.
Ms. Kitt, did you go to the White House with a personal anti-Vietnam War protest?
I did not go to the White House with a personal anything. What I said to Mrs. Johnson upset her? I don't know why it should upset her. I was telling her the truth.
I raised my hand, and I was recognized by the First Lady in order to give my opinions. Now, I was on duty as an American citizen, as I feel I am always on duty as an American citizen. And if I am asked if I have an opinion, then I feel I have the right then to cast those opinions. Therefore, I ask you, do you think I was rude?
Ms. Kitt insists that her movement was spontaneous, not a publicity stunt, although it was followed immediately by a round of press conferences. At least, she thinks she succeeded where picketers and political opponents have failed, in bringing dissent directly to the First Family. Dan Hackle, ABC News, at the White House.
Liz Carpenter gives the Johnsons hourly updates on how the press is handling the incident and on the letters and telegrams coming into the White House. 90% favorable to Lady Bird, she says, white and black. Chicago Mayor Richard Daley calls LBJ and Lady Bird to lend his support.
Mrs. Daley had a meeting of 500 women last night, and they adopted a tremendous resolution for Lady Bird. You tell her. You tell her.
Yes, sir, Mr. Mayor.
Oh, Lady Bird, how are you here?
Fine, thank you, sir.
I just wanted to tell you, Mrs. Daley had a meeting of 500 women housewives in our ward last night, and they adopted a resolution complimenting you upon your great patience in the recent incident.
And thank you, sir.
Meanwhile, Kitt has allies of her own. Rat Pack performer Sammy Davis Jr. says that while he personally wouldn't have done it, it looks to me like she got tired of listening to the platitudes and bland assurances that something will be done about the ghettos. Bill Cosby, who's the first black actor to star in a network TV series, goes on the quirky counterculture show from WGBH, What's Happening, Mr. Silver, and takes aim at beautification.
Now you have Lady Bird Johnson and the rest of these wives down there that live very well and do very well, and they want to talk about putting flowers out on the highway and things like that. Well, that wasn't what was on Eartha's mind. I'm hip that she must have listened and got very tired of the women talking and stood up and said what she said.
Kitt made a decision in the moment at the White House to say what was on her mind. Wasn't that what she was there for? But she pays for that choice. The FBI and CIA deliver a dossier on Kitt to the White House, one that's been in the works since her European days. Radio stations stop playing her songs. Commercial sponsors pressure venues to cancel her appearances. She's written off Batman. Her final episode is titled The Jokes on Catwoman.
Your Honor, I move for a new trial.
On which of several grounds?
On the grounds of a prejudicial jury.
You don't know how prejudicial, Batman.
In the fall of that year, she goes on tour in Europe. One song that seems to define the moment is When Evening Falls, I'm Leaving.
I'm leaving, and I'm not looking back.
Eartha Kitt spends the next few decades in professional exile.
'Cause then I know I won't be grieving.
Coming up on In Plain Sight, a country ready to erupt.
I have some very sad news for all of you. Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
A president on the edge.
He was crying, but he didn't have time to cry. What was in Lyndon's mind was something I'd heard him say. I do not believe I can unite this country.
And LBJ makes an announcement that shocks everyone except Lady Bird.
Good evening, my fellow Americans. Tonight I want to speak.
That's coming up next on In Plain Sight, Lady Bird Johnson. In Plain Sight was written and executive produced by Adam Pincus and me, Julia Swag. It's based on the work I did for my book, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight. Executive producers for ABC are Victoria Thompson and Eric Johnson. Our producer is Ann Carkey. Ali Gallo is our associate producer. Susie Liu is ABC's archival producer. Associate producers for Archival are Isabel Dorval and Dana Schaefer. This episode was edited by Adrian Lilly, with additional editing by Vanessa Lowe and help from Lindsay Cradwell. It was mixed by Dean White. Our theme music is Crossbone Style by Cat Power. Original music is composed by Sam Retzer. Our music supervisor is Linda Cohen. Our artwork is by Teddy Blanks at Chips NY. Special thanks to Kevin Pham at Best Case Studios. And thanks to Joshua Cohan, Liz Alessi, and Stacia Deshishku at ABC Audio, Mike Kelly and Beth Hoppe at ABC News Longform, and Ian Rosenberg and Kimberly Brown, who handled our legal and standards review. In Plain Sight is a co-production of Best Case Studios and ABC Audio. Some material was edited for clarity and time. Be sure to subscribe to the In Plain Sight podcast, and if you like what you heard, leave us a review. Listen to new episodes every Monday.